Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXCV, Q&A VIII. I've lost track. Are we up to eight?
Is it that many?
In which you, the listeners, ask questions on Roman history topics and we provide the answers. Let me just confirm that. Yes. Confirmed. This is Q&A VIII. There we go. Hello, Rhiannon.
Hey, Matt. I feel like I'm losing sense of the past. I didn't realize we've done seven.
Yeah. Well, we're getting near episode CC. So there we go. We have been doing it for a while. So about a week or so ago, we put out the call for Roman-related questions for a good old Q&A episode, and you, the lovely listeners, have provided. So we've got a list. Shall we power through?
We've got a lot of great questions, and we need the usual disclaimer that we won't get to all of them because there were so many.
No, we won't get to all of them. There were quite a lot. Thank you all. You are all lovely. And thank you for all the great feedback as well and the lovely compliments and well wishes and so on and so forth. So, shall we start? This question is from Manu in Belgium. Was Antony ever formally rehabilitated, as he was the ancestor of more members of the imperial family than Octavian?
Sick burn on Octavian there.
I know. I feel like we should do a count, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's true. He is. Even without counting them, I can tell that. Yeah. Although Octavian would probably challenge Will with, well, I adopted.
Yeah. So asterisk counts there. Yeah.
Yeah, look, I think this is a really good question. Almost impossible to definitively answer because there's no official record of... I mean, I guess there is a kind of official record of him being made an enemy of the people. So I shouldn't say there's no official record of him being ostracized.
Yeah.
But of it happening the other way, no.
The enemy of the people was made, though, while he was blatantly an enemy of the people, as far as Octavian is concerned. Mm. I feel like that while they mightn't have rehabilitated him per se, they just might have gone a bit easier on him.
Yeah, look, I think there are various sort of roundabout ways of thinking about this that show that there is a kind of image makeover happening.
Mm.
And one of the things that happens, for example, is after Antony's dead, well, almost certainly after he's dead, when people come to think about or write the history of the triumvirate, and one of the things they have to deal with is the proscriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a lot of important people who are still around who were affected by the proscriptions, who had their land taken away or members of their family killed.
Yeah, okay.
That there's a kind of whitewashing of the triumvirs. So Octavian never gets the blame.
Mm-hmm.
And even the other two, because of proximity to him, because they were in that gang together, they also don't really get tarnished by it. So somebody who does get the blame shifted to them in, say, Appian and Dio is Fulvia.
Okay.
They just say, oh, it was Fulvia who was mad keen. You know, she was rolling around with Cicero's head and she was mad for getting this person's land.
So that was Antony's wife at the time.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, we should explain that. Yes. So she's long dead. She died in 40, I think it was.
Mm.
So it's easy to say, oh, it was some terrible woman,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Antony therefore wasn't responsible.
Okay.
So I think it's complicated because it's part of the makeover of Octavian.
Mm-hmm.
Means we need to shift blame a little bit further from Antony. And similarly with Actium, with the war against Cleopatra and Antony, blame shifted to Cleopatra, which makes it a foreign war.
She was foreign, yeah.
And another woman.
Mm.
So it's not really put up as a war between two Roman generals.
That's
so
interesting.
It's sort of happening, but maybe not quite in the way you'd think.
Okay, and just for those of us playing at home, how does the Julio-Claudians get caught up with Antony as an ancestor? Just follow that through line for us.
So his daughter Antonia,
yeah,
is the mother of Claudius.
Yes.
You've done this without giving me any notice that we were going to be doing family trees.
I thought you'd know it off the back of your head.
There would have been a time, but I'm getting old.
Wow. We've been doing this podcast since 2014.
Yeah, it's a long, long time. And so, you know, that's connection to all of the Julio-Claudians. It's all through Antony's daughter, Antonia. So his daughter with Octavia.
Mm-hmm.
So she's the mother of Claudius. And also of Germanicus, who's the father of Caligula.
Okay, yeah.
And Germanicus is also the father of Agrippina, who's the mother of Nero.
Mm.
So we get those last three Julio-Claudians related back to Antony.
Yes. Okay. And Nero's got it coming from both directions, doesn't he?
Nero should have been the golden product of the Julians and the Claudians.
Or if you want to look at it this way, he got double barrel of Mark Antony's bad habits.
Yeah, that's true. And he's really got it that through Agrippina. So she's the one with the connections to both sides of the family.
Mm.
And of course, she gets it in the neck from our sources.
Yes. Okay, thanks for that question, Manu. Next question that we've got here is from Joseph Lucero from Seattle in the USA. Hello, Joseph. Ancient Greek had different dialects such as Attic and Doric. I thought they were columns, but okay, that shows what I know. Yeah.
Doric, but not Attic.
I was baiting you by saying that. I got the eye roll that I was after. Did classical Latin have regional dialects? If so, what made them distinct? And were some viewed as more prestigious than others?
Yeah, look, really good question. And there's probably a lot more of this than we know about, because, of course, we don't have any recordings. We don't have dialects that seem to be as distinct as, say, Iolic, Doric, etc. When that's written down in Greek, it looks different. You learn different endings.
Oh, okay.
And that kind of thing is as extreme as that. And the E sound is slightly different. I've got a couple of responses to this. My main one is, and it's a bit frustrating because I can't tell you how, but there's a famous criticism of the historian Livy, who wrote the History of Rome, that very long, long, long history. And according to a man called Gaius Asinius Pollio, whose writing we don't have, but we have this recorded in Quintilian, Pollio says that Livy had patawinitas, which means that way of talking or writing from Padua, from northern Italy.
He had a funny accent.
It seems to be. We don't know whether it's about his expression, you know, the way he writes or the kind of vocabulary he uses. We think it's likely it is about his accent as well, though, that he speaks Latin with that kind of northern Italian accent.
Yes.
He writes it in that way. Quintilian doesn't quote to us what that means, very frustratingly, or Pollio didn't expand on it.
Mm.
So we think that Livy might have spoken a slightly different kind of Latin, and presumably true Latin, as it were, received pronunciation Latin would be from Rome.
Mm.
And of course, northern Italy, where Livy was born, wasn't technically part of Italy at that time. It was incorporated, well, at least when Livy was born, it was incorporated in the 40s BCE. So technically it was Gaul, so thought of as kind of northern and a bit uncultured.
Yeah.
Whereas further south, there must have been lots of influence of Greek.
Mm.
So Greek was still very widely spoken in southern Italy, and presumably the form of Latin, and certainly still the form of Italian that's spoken there is Greek influenced.
Yeah.
So I think you can tell that that's always come through there. And we know that there must have been influence of local languages on Latin, because it's a second language for lots of those people in the empire. You can see it sometimes on inscriptions. You can see it with what we would think of as misspellings, which probably reflected pronunciation. So maybe it's the vowel that's wrong. You get an A instead of an E, something like that.
Mm.
So you know the way that we nastily make fun of New Zealanders for the way they pronounce the letter I?
Lovingly rib.
Oh, sorry. I think I feel bad that Australia does this. But yeah, pronouncing the it sound as an uh sound.
Yeah.
So I imagine there were similar vowel shifts throughout the empire.
Yeah. It makes sense that if somebody in Rome speaks Latin and somebody from Gaul speaks Latin, that you're going to grow up with not just different pronunciations of words, but also different words for common items. You know?
And there are some, I mean, Gaelic is a good example, because there are some Gaelic words that fall into Latin. So there's a little bit coming the other way.
Yeah.
Far and wide, it's Latin wiping out other languages.
But you get the odd word.
You do get the odd one coming back. I think part of the problem, if you want to call it a problem, is that Latin seems to have been written down earlier in the history.
Mm.
So Greek, because of its history, it just develops in different ways. And maybe because it's a maritime culture.
Yeah.
That there's not as much sharing. There's probably all kinds of other historical and cultural reasons. Whereas Latin seems to have a standard form very early. So you don't get those dialects being reflected in the written form.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And they seem much more successful at standardizing. And there's a big concern with that amongst Roman intellectuals. They talk about grammar much earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think while Greek was kind of allowed to develop locally, Latin doesn't really do that. It's much better at imposing a form.
Yeah.
And because what we've got is written forms, we don't get the flavor of the way Latin must have been differentiated in different parts.
All right. Thank you for that question, Joseph. The next one that we'll take is from Martin in Poland. Did Romans celebrate their birthdays? They did celebrate them by naming a month after themselves at the appropriate time.
Yeah. Only certain Romans get that, don't they? And it's all a bit skew-whiff with Augustus because he wasn't born in August. But yeah, they all celebrated them. And they celebrated in ways that seem very familiar, at least to what we do here in our culture, which is by giving presents.
Okay.
So there are poems in Martial where he talks about gifts. We've talked before about how he talks about Saturnalia gifts. He also talks about birthday gifts in his short epigrams. And they had banquets or dinners, so parties, I guess, like we would have. They also carry out religious rituals, which might be a bit less familiar to us.
Yeah.
So ritual offerings on your birthdays. You've gone a step further even than I was thinking of by talking about naming months, but they started to celebrate the birthdays of the emperors.
Yes, okay.
So Augustus's birthday becomes a celebration and a time for offering and a holiday very quickly.
That comes down to religion as well, though.
Yeah, that merges with religion, absolutely, when he's deified. I mean, it's something we still sort of do. We have Queen's birthday that we got a couple of months ago.
Oh, it's Martin Luther King Day. But much like Augustus, the Queen's birthday is not celebrated on the Queen's birthday.
No, she's got two.
Well, I think it's even different in states down here, isn't it?
It's just a designated day when we get a holiday.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is different in different states. It's all very strange. So it's like it doesn't have to directly reflect that, whereas your personal birthday still and back in ancient Rome would have been the actual day.
Did you want to read out Martial?
So there's a genre of poetry as well, which is celebrating someone's birthday. And there's an example from Martial. I can't say it's one of Martial's best, but it's short, so I'll read it anyway.
Any Martial is good, Martial.
If you but believe me, Quintus Avidius, I love, as you deserve, the 1st of April, your natal day, as much as I love my own 1st of March. Very convenient that they're both 1st of the month there.
Mm.
Happy is either morn, and may both days be marked by us with the whitest of stones. The one gave me life, the other a friend. Yours, Quintus, gave me more than my own.
Well, that's quite sweet.
It is sweet, but you don't expect sweet from Martial.
No, but you expect him to call him an April Fool.
I mean, it's good in a way that he's not writing nasty invective for someone on their birthday, I suppose. But we see it in Horace as well. There are other poets who seem to produce these birthday poems.
Mm.
And I suppose if you're a poet, that is a gift you can give.
Yeah.
It doesn't cost you money.
Okay. Next question is cheapskate. Tim from the United States, not you, Marshall. Tim asks, who would Romans have considered to be the first emperor as we understand the idea, especially since they had dictators before and Augustus used more unofficial titles like princeps?
It's a difficult one, and that's why I like it. The title princeps is technically a senatorial term. So it is a kind of official term, but it's not an official term for what we think of as an emperor, which is why it's so useful to Augustus, because it doesn't look like he's becoming an emperor. Almost certainly they realized, certain of them realized that there was a big change being brought about by Augustus, and some of them really did not like it, especially in the senatorial class. But because he'd used the term princeps, because he wasn't using dictator, they couldn't really pin monarchy on him. But it must have gradually become obvious that that was what was happening when he didn't.
He had a long reign for it to.
He did. And look, it was papered over in all kinds of ways because technically he didn't have the powers of dictator. A lot of what he had was authority rather than power. But then he did have tribunician power. And, you know, that's a lot of power because it's veto. And the authority meant that he could name consuls, and the consulship kind of becomes a point of honor rather than real power. So all of that is changing. I would say there are two arguments here, so I'm sorry, I'm fence sitting. Either when Tiberius becomes princeps, because that's a transfer of power, we're not going back to two consuls, we're going to one man.
Yeah.
Or when the Julio-Claudians fold with the death of Nero and we just get another dynasty.
Okay.
One of those two points. And I think I might go for the death of Nero because I think it's really insidious and gradual. We have civil war after Nero. They're fighting for something.
Mm.
What they're fighting for is close to what we would call being an emperor.
That's really getting on. Okay.
Yeah, I've gone for the late date. Some people would disagree with me. It's not a definitive date, I'm sorry, and a bit of a wishy-washy answer, but it's the best we can get to. It is a really interesting question.
Okay, the next question that we've got is from Joseph Zagari from Sydney, Australia. How much of the Roman Empire remains in the modern world? I don't think he means structurally. Go for kind of concepts.
Lots of things remain, don't they? I mean, you could give the list from Life of Brian and a lot of that's still around, isn't it?
There's roads. Yeah.
We've got the heating, the running water, concrete, although ours isn't as good. So what remains is a kind of shadow of Roman concrete in some ways.
Mm.
I guess more concepts are things like the systems of time, like the calendar. Now, we did have to change the calendar in the 16th century because the Julian calendar was going a bit off.
I had to tweak it.
But we still have, you know, the names of the months. They come from ancient Rome and, broadly speaking, the number of days in each month.
Mm.
We do deal with weeks differently, but a lot of our terms for the words, such as the months, do come from Latin. Our writing system, our alphabet, is the one that the Romans used.
Sure, yeah.
A few extra letters that largely came in from Greek that they were using even then. And building on that, Latin-derived words. So I think it's been estimated that about 60% of our vocabulary, maybe even 70, comes ultimately from Latin.
Yeah.
Via a lot of it from Norman French. And along the same lines, you could say that Latin didn't die and became all of those Romance languages, especially Italian. You've got all of that related to language that's still very important if you speak English or any of those Romance languages, which is a lot of the world because, you know, Spanish and Portuguese in South America. Also, I think you could say that Greece is also a big influence here, but in terms of politics, ideas like populism. In the podcast at the moment, we're dealing with the end of the Republic. That's what we're recording on. And populism plays a big part in that. Mm. So, you know, Julius Caesar being seen as a popularis and then that kind of support flowing on to Antony or Octavian. And indeed, dictatorship. But like a lot of terms, like a lot of these political terms, you could say the same for Senate, it's interesting to look at the way that shifted. So being the dictator, if you took it as a temporary role, wasn't seen as a negative for ancient Rome. It was dealing with a crisis, but it became a negative partly because of Caesar not giving it up.
Yeah.
And now it's entirely negative in the way we use it.
And you get terms shifting, but taking inspiration, I guess, from Roman things. The Senate, as you say, is probably a good example of that. Next question that we'll take is from Jan Pauline Pohl. Who is sending hugs from the Philippines.
Oh, thanks.
Ah, big hug to the Philippines. That sounds a bit weird. What are some of the most famous and or believed superstitions, and what are your faves? Also keeping my fingers crossed for another lesson in Latin.
I'm absolutely up for doing that.
Yeah? Okay, right. Add that to the list. Okay, superstitions.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's interesting because what do you regard as a superstition? There's an easy way of answering this, which is, you know, I think we have a pretty clear idea.
Mm.
And in a way, most of what the Romans believed we would call superstition.
Well, that's the thing. You kind of get the crossover with religion.
Yeah.
Religious beliefs, you get also omens come under superstition. So it's a very kind of broad category.
It is. But I think we're not going to just talk about the whole of Roman religion under this category. Mm. The Romans themselves had that word superstitio, which gives us, going back to a former question, gives us the word superstition. And it wasn't a negative originally, but it did become one. And they would often use it for foreign religions. So what the Gauls believed, or the Druids, and that kind
of
thing.
Okay, because one of the superstitions that came to mind for me was the Roman tendency to adopt a foreign god and slap a Roman god on top of it and build a temple. The Gaulish god that I know from Asterix Totatis being associated with Mars, the god of war. So temples to that kind of thing. But you get these as well cropping up in England quite a lot.
That's syncretism, the bringing together of the local god. So there's Aquae Sulis, which is the goddess Minerva merged with some local sun god, actually. So I don't know why Minerva, especially worshipped around modern Bath.
Mm.
So
the idea behind it was making Roman gods more acceptable to the locals.
Yeah, if they thought it through. We've got a long way from superstition.
Sorry,
actually. That was my fault. But to get back probably closer to what this question is asking, a major one that I guess is still used today, so some people maybe don't see it as superstition, but I immediately thought of horoscopes. There's a lot of belief in horoscopes and having your horoscope drawn up. that was not seen by the Romans as, oh, you know, weird and credulous people believe in it.
Yeah.
In fact, it was really powerful, and there's kind of injunctions against making the emperor's horoscope because they didn't want people to know when the emperor might die and bring it on somehow.
Mm.
So that's something that's quite ubiquitous that I think we would generally, I don't want to speak for everyone, but I think generally we see it as more entertainment than really forecasting what will happen to you.
Yeah.
One that I particularly like is bees. Bees are, you know, really important now. But for the Romans, they were generally a good omen, except if there's a swarm of them.
Right.
So, you know, which makes sense because that can be quite dangerous.
Yeah.
And that seems to be all brought together with another superstition / religious issue, which is if a sacrifice goes bad,
yeah,
if it goes wrong, which I guess, you know, if the animal doesn't die quickly or if you find weird body parts inside it, that kind of thing. This comes together in this story that I've got a quote from Appian, Book 2, 68, Civil Wars, just before the night of Pharsalus, the battle between Caesar and Pompey. When Pompey was sacrificing the same night, some of the victims escaped. So that's bad. That's not just dying badly. They got away before they were sacrificed and they couldn't be caught. And a swarm of bees, torpid creatures, settled on the altar, says Appian. Shortly before daylight, a panic occurred in the army.
Mm.
So he implies those two things are related.
Okay.
There was a bad omen related to bees and also the sacrifice going wrong. And the army just, you know, this probably did not help with their fortunes and they lost that battle. They had bad vibes going into the battle.
Yeah, yeah. But there's always something to attribute to a defeat as well.
Yeah, that too. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it could be very post fact because Appian knows very well that Pompey lost this battle.
Mm.
My favorite one of all, though, the text that it's in would see itself as a medical text. And that is in the Elder Pliny, when he's talking about cures for illnesses.
Yeah.
He says that if you get what he calls the Latin equivalent of a breastband and put it around your head, it will cure your headache.
Yeah.
Pliny's brassiere, as it's often called. The idea there's some kind of numinous, powerful quality in the underwear of a woman that can transfer to curing pain.
I just love that Pliny was once caught doing something and came up with a madcap answer that maybe everyone bought. And next thing you know, it's the fashion in Rome. Eternal flame, Temple of Vesta. That was my response to superstitions.
Okay.
Yeah.
You need to say more than that.
Flame goes out in the Temple of Vesta, Rome will fall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
This is a question from Philip Lillingston in Melbourne. When a Roman was fulfilling his 20 years of service, if in a colony, was he allowed 3 weeks of holiday back home every year? Did they get holiday leave if you were a Roman soldier?
Well, apparently they did. So we've got a quote from Vegetius. This is kind of his Epitoma Rei Militaris, which is a summary of military stuff. When anyone receives a leave of absence, the comitatus, and for how many days, it is noted down in lists. So it did happen, saying that. For in antiquity, and he means the early empire when he says that, it was difficult to be given unless for very good approved reasons. It seemed incongruous that a soldier of the emperor, maintained in uniform and pay and rations at public expense, should have time to serve private interests. So largely no, but if you...
It sounds like it was frowned upon.
Yeah, and also it's a case-by-case situation.
Yeah.
So if your commander, say, is sympathetic to the fact that your family member is very ill and probably going to die soon, or you're going to lose your property if you don't rush home, then maybe... Equally, they might just say no.
And what's to stop you from deserting, really, and just not coming back if you go? Yeah.
Well, getting caught and killed.
Well, you know, anyway. Next question that we'll take is from Carl Geppert in Melbourne. What can you tell us about culture, i.e. we know about the big ticket items, theatre, games, racing, and we see paintings and mosaics. So there's a lot. But what else is there besides that? Did people go out and hear music or see a particular singer? Was there a foodie culture? How much was music brought to popularity from diverse sources across the breadth of the empire?
It's a big question.
Mm.
I'll take it in bits. So very famous. We've got the arena, the gladiators, the circus.
That's all culture.
Theatre, yeah. The question about music, and I know there are people working on this, recreating ancient music is really hard. So we don't know how much music or song spread, except where we've got written sources, which tend to be poetry.
Yeah.
And I guess the poetry that's most associated with music is lyric poetry, but originally all poetry was set to music, and that got spread around the empire. And the musical instruments turn up in these other places. And again, there's a connection between some of this comes from Greece, some of it's Roman, and it gets spread around. But I'm being really vague here because we really don't know much.
Yeah.
People did go out to hear music, maybe not in the way we might go to a concert or a symphony.
Yeah.
It's more that it accompanies usually dramatic action. So it's not just the plays. Much more popular are things like mimes and pantomime.
Yeah.
Which would have had music as well as kind of slapstick and more broad comedy.
Mm.
And there were particular actors who were seen as really important. For example, during the time of Domitian, there was the actor Paris, who was supposed to have had an affair with Domitia and was a draw card. So a name that you would want to see if he was on stage.
Domitia thought so.
Well, yes. Or not on stage in her case, well, possibly.
Never know.
So there are actors who are popular, remembering always that actors at the same time, like gladiators, they're infames, they've got no legal position, so they're kind of despised at the same time as they're glamorized. Was there a foodie culture? Well, we do have ancient cookery books. There's a cookery book by Apicius. And it's a foodie culture I wouldn't want to have participated in because it's mostly fish sauce. Lots of honey as well. I suppose that would be very nice.
Sweet
and fresh.
And sour.
Yeah. And that does seem to indicate that there's some quite elaborate food being made.
Mm.
And it kind of usually comes from sources that are negative about it. But we know there was extravagant food because we have writers that criticize emperors in particular for engaging in extravagant banquets.
Yeah.
So this is a bit removed because it's a work of fiction. But Petronius's Satyricon, Petronius writing at the time of the Emperor Nero, has a banquet scene called the Dinner of Trimalchio, where this fabulous dinner is served in many, many courses, where food is kind of dressed up as different things. So you get what looks like an entire boar that's been roasted, but in fact it hasn't been cooked at all. And when it's cut open, birds fly out of it, and there's kind of food, meat and stuff that's been cooked inside, but it's not pig meat.
So it's dinner and entertainment.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of is.
And then you've got the whole pearls and vinegar thing from Pliny writing about Antony and Cleopatra.
Yeah. So the extravagant dinner, you can see there might have been competition, despite the fact that our moralistic sources seem to look down on this.
Did you get anybody like a Beyoncéus, or I guess it'd be Beyoncé, a massive performers who would go and perform for the emperor, I guess, if they were in Rome? We've got notable gladiators, we've got notable actors. You'd think that we'd have a notable singer.
The only parallel I can think of is because of the pull of the emperor, and he can ask for whoever he wants, is, you know, they'd get certain poets to come in, like Augustus made Virgil come in and read out or perform bits of the Aeneid. That's not singing, it's not music.
Yeah.
It's epic poetry. So because poetry seems to have held a much wider cultural pull than it does, alas, now.
Mm.
It's a bit like pop music in some ways, more than you might think of poetry being.
I can see what you mean. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Next question.
Yeah.
This is from Peter from Sydney. When did it become customary for elite children to learn Greek? And when did Latin cease to be spoken at all? Those are two very big questions, Peter. I assume sometime quite late in the Eastern Empire. This is Peter assuming that.
Okay, so in terms of Rome's contact with Greece, it had been going for a couple of centuries by this point, but it seems to be second century, maybe early to mid second century, that Greek culture becomes a marker of being a cultured person.
BCE.
So, yeah, BCE, yes.
Okay.
All numbers, all dates are BCE unless I say otherwise.
Oh, okay.
I just assume everything older. The big date is, I think from memory, 167.
Mm.
A lot of Greek culture, movable stuff, including slaves, is brought to Italy. Libraries start being brought in around that time. And with those slaves, the educated amongst them would have been employed. We know were employed in rich Roman households to teach their children Greek.
Yeah.
So early second century, I'd say it's starting. And from then on, you have to know Greek if you're going to show any education at all as a Roman. You have to have Greek books in your library. You have to know the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Yeah.
You need to know your Homer at the very least, but preferably more Greek culture than that. And Quintilian has a whole list of Greek works that you need to know as a Roman orator. And of course, an educated Roman, certainly a male Roman, and but we know there were female orators too, had to have that literature at their fingertips to refer to it.
Okay. And as for the Latin ceasing to be spoken at all?
Well, I think I've already answered that it didn't cease to be spoken because it turned into the Romance languages, a slightly facetious answer. So when did Latin cease to be spoken at all? It's starting to change even in the first century CE, it's starting to change in some ways. So what we've got written is going to be much more conservative than what's being spoken. So this goes back to what we're saying about accents, that there's a form of Latin that's kind of fixed in time that might not reflect the way people are talking. Almost certainly didn't.
Yeah, okay. So you've got slang creeping into the language, but that's not going to be reflected in the written record.
Yeah, but you can see the language is changing. And again, I refer to inscriptions, mistakes on inscriptions that do things like the letter V sometimes is misinscribed as a B. That's a sound change that goes on. These might seem like tiny little irrelevant things, but these are part of the change into those Romance languages, or a late form of Latin that becomes those Romance languages. It happens so gradually that I cannot give you a date. And also, we don't have very firm evidence, but I'm going to refer to him twice in one episode. Petronius's Satyricon shows some of those changes happening, and they're changes of verb endings. They're meant to be mistakes. They're what ordinary people are using to speak, because he's satirizing freedmen. And if he's right, because he's an elite Roman, he might just be making fun of freedmen.
Yeah.
But if he is reflecting the way ordinary people were speaking on the street, then it looks like some of those important changes were happening even at that time in spoken Latin.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But all my questions are going to end up with, it's hard, all my answers, it's hard to say because of the lack of evidence. But the changes that led to Latin becoming other languages are already there in the first century CE. And I suppose you can see the divergence happening when Latin, or a form of Latin, becomes Church Latin, which is different to classical Latin. And that becomes fixed as a written form in itself. And those who are still using Latin, because it is still used through the medieval period as a spoken language.
I just thought you meant the Vatican, but sure.
No. All throughout Christian Europe. And it's kind of what we call a lingua franca. So if you want to talk to somebody in England, I guess Britannia, and they speak their local language and you speak a form of Gaelic, then you both speak Latin. So I guess it's like English is today.
Yeah, true.
Which is lucky for us and not so much for non-English speakers. Yeah. So it's a question with lots of answers. Latin continued in various different guises and arguably still continues today. If you wanted to put a date on it, and there are experts out there who would probably give more refined answers than this, then somewhere in the 5th century. It's later than you think.
Okay, thank you for that. Those two questions that you stuck in there, Peter, from Sydney. One that I highlighted here and will answer myself, but Rhianna might have some to say about this. This is from Russell in Perth, Western Australia. Which emperor was the youngest, which was the oldest, which was the longest serving, and which was the shortest serving? We can answer that in three emperors. So, so longest reign is Augustus, which is a bit sad, really.
First and the best.
40 years, 7 months his reign was.
Although you can argue about when it started.
Yeah, okay. Anyway.
Re-question.
The oldest person who became emperor is Gordian I. He was 80 years old, 79, 80, when he became emperor. And he also had the dubious honor of having the shortest reign of 22 days.
That's how you can answer it in three emperors.
Yeah, that's right. Both he and his son, Gordian II. Gordian I became emperor. This is after the death of Alexander Severus. So if you want to find the Emperors of Rome episodes on them, look back to, these are in 2020. We did episodes on the year of the five emperors. So that's 238 CE off the top of my head. Gordian I and II were emperors after Alexander Severus. They became co-emperors. They were emperors for 22 days before they were executed. And Gordian II's son, after a bit of kerfuffle with a couple more emperors, was put on the throne, I think I can call it at that point, who began his sole rule from the age of 13. He ruled for 5 years, 6 months before he was brutally murdered by one of his soldiers.
I knew there would be someone younger than Nero, but it's terrifying to think Nero was 17.
There was a couple who were younger than Nero. Yeah, Elagabalus was younger than Nero as well. So that all happened in the 1 year. Oldest, shortest reign, and
youngest
emperor.
And didn't work out
well
for either of them.
No, it didn't work out well for anyone at that point because then you got the third century.
That's just the answer to everything. It's the third century. Do you feel that Gordian the First reign does not bode well for Joe Biden?
Similar age, eh? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it shouldn't be a bar and, you know, people live longer these days.
Yeah. But. Well, that's the thing that did occur to me because as soon as I thought, okay, Gordian the First, 79, 80, that's around the age of Joe Biden. Very different life expectancies back then.
Even though I'm the one who brought this up, I should say there's a bit of a misconception that life expectancy, there are different ways of reading it, aren't there? Because infant mortality was so great, it really skews the figures. Mm. So I think especially if you're a man, so you're not going to give birth to children. If you're someone who doesn't give birth to children and you survive to adulthood, it still probably wasn't the kind of life expectancy we would have in Australia for most of us, but still.
But if you're a certain person and you get past a certain point.
And you're the emperor, so you know, you're an elite person getting decent food.
He was getting decent food. I think he might have been a regional governor.
Okay, still. Enough money.
Thanks very much for that, Russell. We've got one final question here. This is a bit of an alternate history kind of thing. This is from Darren from Sudbury in Canada. Would the Republic have fallen if people like Cato were open to negotiating with Caesar? Sometimes I think hardliners in the Senate misplayed the situation and their mistakes led to Caesar to start and win the Civil War. Then I wonder whether becoming sole consul for life was Caesar's plan all along, regardless of what the Senate did. What do you think, Rhiannon?
I love this question, and whatever I say can't be wrong. You know, I think more than some people, I buy into what Caesar tells me, and maybe I'm just a sucker for that, in that he tells me all the time he was trying to make a deal with the Senate, that he was trying to do something reasonable that would allow him to give up his position as a governor, as a proconsul, and enter Rome safely. And the hardliners just wouldn't let him.
Yeah.
So I think both of them might have happened anyway. I think he would have given up his army at that point if he'd been given assurances he wouldn't be put on trial. Given the political scenario of the times and the kind of support he had from the people, sole rule, or maybe the kind of consulship he had in 59, where he was effectively the sole ruler, even though, you know.
Bibulus.
Yeah, Bibulus, well remembered. It wasn't the consulship of Caesar and Bibulus, it was the consulship of Julius and Caesar. He clearly showed that he had the capacity to just take over, even when he was apparently observing the conventions of the Republic. Yeah. So I think he still would have twisted the Republic in a way that meant that he had more authority than you're meant to have. So even if he hadn't been consul every year, he would have had a say over who'd be consul. And this is the way the late Republic was going. Even when you weren't in a magistracy, you were trying to manipulate who was going to be tribune of the plebs. So you had someone in that very powerful position who was going to be proconsul in a really important province.
Well, I guess that's how he got his consulship anyway, really.
Yeah. Well, that's how consulships were happening by that time. You know, there's bribery, there's all kinds of political pressure being put on people. So in a way, that political situation means I don't think we can blame Caesar. I think it's just the Republic was breaking down and we were going to end up with monarchy of some sort. I think Caesar was pushed into a position where he couldn't hide what he was doing, and Augustus was much cleverer. So he got it and claimed it was still the Republic. This really open alternative fact that he lived as so I guess there's a certain inevitability to empire either way. So I've kind of turned myself around on that argument even as I've talked through it. I don't think Caesar was aiming for power at that point, or at least overt power. I think he was driven to civil war. I mean, who wants civil war? You want to gain power by other means if you can, because of the hardliners. So he had to kind of make his position clear much sooner than he would have done.
Sounds a bit opportunistic.
Yeah. But as I say, I don't think it's the way he wanted to do it. I think it's what he ultimately wanted. It's just he would have liked to do it in a more tricky way.
Yeah, if Cato came to the table, and not just Cato. Okay, thanks for that question. Darren. So as is customary at the end of Q&A episodes, Rhiannon, getting you completely off guard here. What episodes are you looking forward to in Emperors of Rome? What have we got coming up?
Well, I think we promised this last time, but Fulvia.
You did promise Fulvia in the last Q&A episode. Fulvia will be our next episode.
Yeah, Fulvia's happening.
Wife of Antony recorded. That will be our next episode, which is good.
I did enjoy looking at her. The evidence is slim and biased, but she's a lot of fun. I am looking forward to another lesson in Latin now. Can we book that in?
I'll put that down on our list, yeah. We'll get to another lesson in Latin. And for the rest of the year, pretty much going out for the next 6 months, will be a number of episodes examining the rest of the fallout between Antony and Octavian. And also Cleopatra.
Yeah, Cleopatra is going to be very important.
Yeah, taking us up to our 200th episode, which we can say now. Yeah, Cleopatra and Antony will be our 200th episode. That's it for our Q&A episode. Thanks very much to everyone who asked questions, those who got answered, and those of you lovely people who we did appreciate your questions that we didn't get to. So until the next episode, thanks very much. Thanks for your time, Rhiannon.
It was a pleasure, Matt.
That was Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I'm at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. As I've previously said, in the next episode of Emperors of Rome, Fulvia. So until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.